in putting this together, and I think for really setting the stage for what's going to be my discussion, which is a little bit more historical, but avoids some of these intricacies of the human rights framework. So thank you for laying those out. Let's wait for a second for this to load. And good morning. It all worked out. In commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I'll be speaking this morning on the World Health Organization's support for human rights, focusing on the universal human right to health in Article 25 of the Universal Declaration. Magic. And so this research chronicles the political dynamics of the World Health Organization in the evolution of the human right to health, focusing on the transition from the aspirational language of the 1948 Universal Declaration to the legal obligations of the 1966 International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. And so scholars have previously reached contradictory conclusions on WHO's role in the advancement and implementation of human rights, finding either that WHO had an influential presence in the evolution of human rights discourse, or that public health and human rights have always evolved along parallel but distinctly separate tracks, joined for the first time at the advent of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. I find that both of these accounts present an incomplete history of WHO's role in the global health governance, overlooking the vital human rights leadership exhibited by WHO in its early years, and the consequences that resulted when WHO renounced its role as a leading voice in health rights. In recognition of the 60th anniversary of both the World Health Organization and the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, I'll examine the legacy of this WHO abandonment of the UDHR's public health obligations, concluding that when WHO has sought to reclaim the mantle of human rights for the public's health, its past neglect of human rights has left it without the legitimacy necessary to implement rights-based health policy and achieve the highest attainable standard of health. And so looking back at the events that took place immediately after the UDHR, my presentation today will trace the development of language for the human right to health, focusing on WHO's role in forming and implementing these legal obligations. Through legal analysis, sorry, I am a lawyer, of the treaty documents, complemented by archival research of the internal communications of both the WHO and the UN, this study examines WHO's contributions to, and in many cases abandonment of, the evolution of international legal language for a human right to health. Really, only by understanding these underlying organizational discourses can we highlight the failures in global health governance that impeded the UDHR from developing into state obligations for health, and prevent ourselves from repeating those failures in the global health challenges to come. There we go. How do we make this? Perfect. The codification of health as a human right begins, as with all human rights, in the context of the Second World War. And so rising out of the cauldron of war and drawing on working class struggles of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, social and economic rights would seek to prevent the deprivations like those that had taken place during the Depression and war that followed. Developing this right in international law, a right to health would be framed by the spirit of the times, including the expansion of post-war European welfare states, the development of human rights in the Americas, and the constitutional framework of Soviet states, all of which addressed underlying societal causes that we now call social determinants of health. And so in the course of this war, US President Roosevelt announced as early as 1941 that the post-war era would be founded upon four essential human freedoms: freedom from speech, freedom from religion, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, and freedom from want. It is the final of these four freedoms, freedom from want, that introduced the state obligation for providing for the health of its peoples. As Roosevelt conceived of it, this freedom from want would be couched in the language of liberty, with an understanding that a necessitous man is not a free man. In the aftermath of the war, the Charter of the United Nations became the first international legal document to recognize the concept of human rights, as Daphne mentioned, raising it as one of the four principal purposes of this new world body. In enumerating and upholding human rights, the UN would operate through its Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC, to translate human rights into legal obligations that would be binding on states' parties. In addition, the UN Charter delegated authority to ECOSOC for health cooperation, advocating the establishment of an international health organization. Notwithstanding this promise of international health cooperation in the UN Charter, the Charter itself proclaims no human right to health, leaving it to subsequent international instruments to codify this right in international law. With the drafting of the UDHR still underway, the rapid adoption of the Constitution of the World Health Organization would make it the first international treaty to define a unique human right to health, encompassing the aspirations of states to build a healthy world out of the ashes of the Second World War, and recognizing an imperative to facilitate international cooperation through global health governance. States signed the WHO Constitution on July 22, 1946, after which it remained open for signature until the WHO came into force on April 7, 1948. In establishing the contours of this right to health under the WHO Constitution, its preamble declares that the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of health is one of the fundamental rights of every human being. Defining health positively to include a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. To implement this expansive, positive vision of health, a vision in line with public health's contemporaneous focus on social medicine, the preamble further declares that governments have a responsibility for the health of their peoples, which can be fulfilled only by the provision of adequate health and social measures. On the heels of this WHO Constitution, the UN proclaimed its UDHR, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, on December 10, 1948, and that's what we're here to celebrate, enacting through it a right to health by which everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services. In preparing this right to a standard of living adequate for health, and again, it's a standard of living adequate for health, there was widespread agreement that a human right to health included both fulfillment of necessary medical care and the realization of underlying determinants of health, including food, clothing, and housing. While this resulting language was less focused than many had hoped, delegates expected this expansive declaratory language would soon be elaborated by specific legal obligations in an international covenant on human rights. And so in moving forward from both the Universal Declaration and its own inauguration, WHO sought to pursue dual policy paths in its work. First, an extension of its previous technical work in international health coordination. And second, an ambitious rights-based project to bring the health resources of the world to bear on major problems and neglected countries. In this latter pursuit, WHO's early years are marked by an active role in drafting human rights treaty language, working with other UN agencies to expand human rights principles for the public's health. The main channel of this human rights cooperation came in translating the rights enumerated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights into first the draft International Covenant on Human Rights, and subsequently in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. I would say ICESCR, but I've been warned against it. Although initial international negotiations were limited to civil and political rights, those freedoms that we have in our own Bill of Rights, WHO nevertheless became heavily involved in these discussions on the topic of human experimentation, drawing on the atrocities of Nazi physicians in crafting human rights language, guaranteeing a freedom against torture, providing an early opportunity to transition to positive human rights obligations for health. The UN General Assembly resolved in December 1950 to expand human rights deliberations to include economic, social, and cultural rights, reaching out to specialized agencies like the WHO in drafting articles within their respective purview. WHO followed up on the direct, WHO Director General Chisholm responded enthusiastically to this invitation in January 1951, quoting from the preambular language of the WHO Constitution and welcoming opportunities to cooperate with the Commission on Human Rights, in drafting international covenants, recommendations, and standards with a view to ensuring the enjoyment of the right to health. To this cooperative end, Director General Chisholm advocated WHO leadership in the right to health, arguing that it is clear that the whole program approved by the World Health Assembly represents a concerted effort on the part of member states to ensure that the right to health, to ensure the right to health. I am well aware of the obligation of WHO to be guided by this fundamental relationship in planning its work with governments, as well as with other international organizations. WHO followed up on the Director General's response in February 1951, suggesting international legal language well beyond the confines of Article 25 of the UDHR, on topics ranging from occupational health, to nutrition, to maternal and child health clinics, to medical and nursing education and research, to international health policy, and noting specific WHO collaborative activities with the International Labor Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, UNESCO, and UNICEF. As for its institutional role under the right to health, Director General Chisholm reiterated in March 1951 to the UN Director General that WHO will advise the Commission on Human Rights on technical matters related to health and will cooperate with the United Nations in assistance to governments. Asserting its leadership in health rights, WHO suggested in April 1951 that the language of the right to health should be drawn from the WHO Constitution and articles abandoned in compromises on the UDHR. Terms in, there we go, that language. Language that emphasizes a positive definition of health, the importance of social measures as underlying determinants of health, government responsibility for health provisions, and again, government, government agents, government actors, all the state, and the role of health ministries in creating measures for what we would now call primary health care. There we go. The UN Commission on Human Rights met in June 1951 to review this evolving legal language on a right to health. Director General Chisholm opened this discussion by pressing for delegates to define health in the covenant, advocating adoption of the definition of health from the WHO Constitution. In the shadow of this impassioned plea for health promotion, Egypt proposed a language similar to WHO that's on the screen here, without the definition of health or government responsibility for social measures, arguing that these ideas were already well represented in the WHO Constitution. When Egypt withdrew this proposal, Chile took up the WHO proposal, noting the importance of public health in South America and suggesting a deletion of paragraphs 4, 5, and 6 as being of secondary importance to the goal of public health. With failed amendments by the Danish and British delegates, the Commission was faced with dueling US and Soviet proposals, as you might imagine. As a compromise to these conflicting proposals by the post-war superpowers, the U.S. proposal, originally intended to replace the entire article, was approved only as a replacement for the opening paragraph, as you see here on the slide. With the Soviet Union critiquing this U.S. proposal for failing to define obligations on governments, its comprehensive amendment on medical care was included only as a replacement for the deleted paragraphs 4, 5, and 6 in the Egyptian proposal and what WHO proposed. And so given strong international support for WHO's proposal, which provided simultaneously for the general recognition of the right in the opening paragraph, and an enumeration of state undertakings in subsequent paragraphs, the French delegate pressed for consensus to be reached on the WHO proposal. And so although delegates in this final submission to ECOSOC had reverted to the highest standard of health obtainable, rather than the expansive WHO definition of complete health, this revised draft on the right to health was by far the most detailed of the economic, social, and cultural rights of that time, with each of the four amended paragraphs approved by wide margins. It was clear that states would bear legal obligations to progressively realize underlying determinants of health through public health systems, focusing on the UDHR's emphasis on a standard of living adequate for health. With Director General Chisholm forwarding this Commission on Human Rights resolution to the WHO Executive Board, he took the opportunity first to highlight the ways in which WHO could have a preeminent role in implementing the right to health, and second, to admonish the Executive Board not to disempower WHO by allowing non-technical UN organs to pass judgment over technical questions. In the ensuing executive board debate, the delegates accepted the director general's recommendations, authorizing WHO leadership on the right to health, while limiting the WHO proposal only to suggest an expansion of legislative measures in the language to legislative and other measures. So a relatively minor compromise within the WHO. To UN observers who were with the executive board at the time, it was clear that the WHO secretariat would be leading initiatives to develop the language of the right to health and to implement that language across the globe. And so with evolving agreement on the substance of the right to health, Cold War divisions would alter the means of implementing it. In January 1952, the UN resolved that in place of a unified international covenant on human rights, the Commission on Human Rights would now draft two separate human rights covenants, requesting ECOSOC, quote, to have the Commission on Human Rights draft two covenants on human rights, to contain civil and political rights, and the other to contain economic, social, and cultural rights, in order that the General Assembly may approve the two covenants simultaneously and open them at the same time for signature. So, separate but equal, I guess. Under this bifurcated framework, the 1952 session of the Commission on Human Rights sought to finalize the language of the right to health, now Article 13 in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Based upon authorization from the Executive Board, Director General Chisholm again proposed that the new covenant make reference to the positive definition of health contained in the WHO Constitution, and that the right to health be amended to recategorize the measures to be taken by states, to include epidemic and endemic diseases and their eradication and control, impairment of health by environmental conditions, deprivation and ignorance, and physical, mental, and social handicaps and their correction or mitigation by suitable care. Given its forceful advocacy for complete health, these WHO proposals now found acceptance in the amendments of state delegates, expanding the purview of the right to health in line with WHO's original vision. As a result, in correcting for a translation error to replace obtainable with attainable standard of health, the draft text of Article 13 was amended to the language here. With the Commission unable to complete its drafting of the two covenants, however, ECOSOC authorized the Commission to revisit the covenants in its 1953 session. But in that interim, WHO would relinquish its leadership in health rights, and the right to health would regress, stumbling backwards toward its completion in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. As the UN sought leadership to expand the right to health in the ICESCR, in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and then expand that promise of health outward to specific groups and specific rights, WHO sought to distance itself from the human rights movement. Rather than taking responsibility for elaborating human rights principles in health, WHO turned its attention to purely technical enterprises, seeking a vertical, disease-specific approach to international public health. Coordinated by its newly elected Director General, WHO abandoned its previous emphasis on global health priorities for the disadvantaged, delegating programs to regional health offices, and decentralizing leadership for health within the UN system. Given this instrumental approach to health, WHO did not seek to fulfill its mandate from a rights perspective, nor did it seek to set legal standards by which states could meet those obligations, with its Director General repeatedly declaring the organization, quote, not to be entrusted with safeguarding legal rights. Throughout 1953, as the Commission on Human Rights sought to finalize the language of the right to health with UN specialized agencies, WHO communicated simply by reprinting technical documents that had no bearing on human rights. When the UN Secretariat summarized the covenants for the General Assembly in 1955, the UN rekindled disputes on the inclusion of a definition of health, the idea of social well-being, and the steps to be taken in the second paragraph. Disputes that went unchallenged by WHO's failure to review or comment on this comprehensive summary. As the UN moved in 1956 to the measures of implementation for the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, Director General Kan Dao responded dismissively that WHO had, quote, no comments to offer concerning new measures which would be necessary in furthering effective observance of the right to health. By the time the right to health moved to the General Assembly in 1957, WHO lacked the legal discourse and human rights credibility to effect change. As delegates summarily eliminated the definition of health in reference to social well-being from the right, WHO personnel were impotent to prevent these deletions. Abandoning its efforts to strengthen health rights, WHO took little part in concluding debates relative to other specialized agencies, and no amendments were offered to expand the positive obligations of this enfeebled right. On January 1957, the General Assembly concluded debate on the right to health. Thereafter, renumbering the right from Article 13 to Article 12 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, but otherwise leaving the right to health unchanged until its codification in the 1966 International Covenant. As the years passed, WHO's continued neglect for health rights in international treaty frameworks squandered opportunities to elaborate the scope and content of health rights beyond the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, leaving Article 12's inadequate obligations as the final international legal norms pursuant to the right to health. In 1959, although the UN requested WHO comments on the Declaration of the Rights of the Child, WHO offered only general support without any substantive comments on the text of the declaration, and health was not included. In 1964, although the UN requested comments on the Declaration on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, WHO considered this to be outside its mandate, finding that the non-discrimination clause in the preamble of the WHO Constitution did not refer to a discrimination on account of gender or sex. And in 1965, although the UN requested comments on the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of racial discrimination, WHO responded blithely that legislation was outside of its competence. Outside of its competence. As Martin Luther King was lashing out on inequalities in healthcare as the most shocking and inhumane of all forms of injustice, health discrimination and inequities in health would not be a part of the international legal debate. And so in the midst of this neglect for treaty development, WHO staff were also engaging in a coordinated campaign to distance the organization from any UN responsibilities in the field of human rights, shirking its reporting requirements by repeatedly announcing that the organization not being entrusted with safeguarding legal rights is not in a position to share in human rights reporting. When the Commission on Human Rights took objection to this, WHO's repeated disclaimer of responsibility for human rights, WHO simply transmitted to the committee its report on the world health situation, while simultaneously requesting that the UN Division on Human Rights eliminate the section on health from its human rights summaries. With great offense taken on all sides, WHO then excised itself entirely from the human rights process and measures of progress on the protection of human rights, arguing that the provisions contained in Article 25 of the Declaration, Article 25 that we're talking about today at the American Public Health Association, that these provisions contained in Article 25 of the Declaration in their letter and spirit go substantially beyond the competence of the World Health Organization. And so as a result, the UN's 1968 review of human rights efforts taken by specialized agencies includes only vague generalities on the right to health and enumerates activities taken by all specialized agencies except WHO. And so in thinking about the legacy of this WHO neglect for human rights, with states moving independently to adopt the ICESCR and translate its international obligations into national law and national law into government policy, WHO remains silent on its role in promoting and implementing human rights. Given these missed opportunities to provide a human rights basis for its work, WHO faced emasculation in its human rights authority, and the right to health suffered attenuation in its state obligations. When WHO sought to reclaim human rights in the 1970s, mainstreaming the right to health and its health for all strategy, and the Declaration of Alma-Ata, pretty poster on the screen. WHO was hobbled in these efforts by its inability to engage with the language of legal rights or set standards under international legal agreements. Where WHO had long sought to address health issues through direct medical action, in the absence of human rights frameworks, the inherent limitations of this approach would become transparent in the failure to achieve rights-based primary health care through the Declaration of Alma-Ata. Not until it was too late, WHO chose to avoid this human rights imperative, denying its health recommendations the force of international law. This enduring neglect for international legal approaches to health has led the right to health to fall from the UDHR's promise of legal rigidity to its current state of aspirational fluidity, rarely litigated or legislated. And so the 1948 WHO Constitution envisioned an expansive role for human rights protections and promotion in realizing the highest attainable standard of health. But WHO failed to live up to this role. Where WHO focused on health as a set of functional problems, rather than as a human right, it failed to achieve both, undercutting its own practical health goals by denying them a grounding in human rights law. WHO possesses invaluable technical expertise in public health matters, giving it preeminent legitimacy in developing public health standards and monitoring state programs. However, the WHO must be competent to ground these programs pursuant to human rights frameworks if it is to bind states meaningfully to achieve health for all. As we approach the 60th anniversary of both the WHO and the UDHR, WHO has re-engaged primary health care under its resurrected Health for All strategy. The just-released World Health Report, entitled Primary Health Care, Now More Than Ever, notes striking public health inequities within and between countries and calls for a return to the primary health care approach of Alma-Ata. To the extent that it enlists its new human rights officials in this effort, it's hoped this step may serve as a final reconciliation of the World Health Organization with its obligations under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so this is really the test, and now is really the time for the WHO to show its human rights medal. And thank you very much for your attention. I'm actually continuing the story, if you're around this afternoon, into the 1970s and 1980s. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ben. I think it's really useful for us to hear about this process because I know that, you know, I kind of gave that timeline and I talked about how difficult it is to bring people together from different countries. And Ben, I know, and I've done archival research as well, going in and reading through those documents where it says, the representative from France objects to the use of the word legislative measures. And the representative from the USSR suggests putting the word legislative or other. So those are very tedious research tasks. And I think it helps us all to appreciate, you know, that this is these documents have such a long gestation period, you know, 10 years to get those paragraphs, which we look to as, you know, the way in which we define the right to health today. So that's so useful to have that kind of historical perspective.